Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
What we're going to be looking at today is the first of two chats about how railways are at the moment. And we'll close, I think, on a third talk, both what's next, and that will be it, and summing up some of the themes. And I want to start at the railway station in Niamey, N-I-A-M-E-Y, which is currently in the news. It is the capital of Niger, which those who follow the news will know is at the moment affected by a coup. That may well lance hopes that had been placed that it should be a node in a the post-colonial rail system in Africa. But let's first look at how that project had already gone. The railway station there was the first opened in Niger, and it was part of the Africa Rail project. And it can be instructive because of the repeated stress in much of the literature about rail and much of the news about new routes and services. So, you know, this comment is on Africa. The same thing could be said about countries like Britain with HS2 and other countries as well, or as I was saying last time, bold schemes in California. Now, the station was to be the terminus of a projected 563-kilometre line from Benin, which itself was the terminus of an existing 438-kilometre line from the Atlantic coast, which finished by the French, the colonial power, in 1936. And the whole thing was part of what was originally part of the Blue Line project, for which $2 billion was costed, for a 3,000-kilometre rail link, which included the existing line, and that was to go from Niamey via Burkina Faso to Ivory Coast. So in other words, up from Benin to Niger, down to the Ivory Coast, replacing the hinterland's reliance on lorries, cutting the costs of exports and imports. Now, the opening ceremony exposed the gap between reality and are, as it were, what could be going on. The opening, so the station was opened in 2014, and the presidents of Benin, Niger, and Togo attended. And, you know, sort of high hopes were held. But in fact, the inaugural train had only 500 metres, that's half a kilometre, of track to operate on, and carried the visiting dignitaries round and round, which for those of us interested in train travel had limited value. By 2016, it's true, a 145-kilometre line had been opened within Niger with seven other stations, but no trains have used this route since 2017. The stations, which were anyway pretty limited, have rotted, and there is no sign that this will change. And the instability of the region, which I was already commenting on, will discourage further investment. And this is significant because, as readers who know about trains may know, there are also bold plans for lines from Dakar in Senegal through the Sahel, countries like Niger and Chad, to the Red Sea. Well, no, it's not going to happen. Now, what is worth bearing in mind, and I've drilled into this a bit because it's interesting, it shows that it's not just a question of state failure, it's a question of entrepreneurial capitalism. The West African Rail proposals highlighted a rivalry between a Romanian-Australian industrialist who was head of Pan African Minerals, who ran the major manganese mine in northeastern Burkina Faso, in close to Niger, and a Frenchman, Vincent Bolloré, who played a major part in the opening ceremonies at Niamey. Bolloré was to hold 40% of the project. African Minerals, which the Romanian-Australian industrialist Frank Timmis controlled, went into administration in 2015 and was sold to a Chinese company. But that didn't actually make any difference. And although there has been interest from Indian, Singaporean, Japanese, and Brazilian commercial concerns because of the major manganese mine, nothing really has happened. Bolloré itself has also been active in operating railways in Cameroon, with railway exports a key element. So the point I'm trying to bring out is, you know, people talk about capitalism and colonialism, et cetera, you know, sort of rather stupid British writers, Clindy Andrews, for example, could be seen sounding off about the two together. The practicality is that governments as a whole are dependent, whether you're talking about imperialism or non-imperialism, they're dependent upon sources of capital. And neither those sources of capital nor the governments are necessarily prudent, sound in their finances, or able to fulfill their expectations. In fact, if you look at what had happened by 2017, Bolloré, you know, his construction stopped 6 kilometres in the middle of nowhere, leaving a scene which is worthy of record and is should be. I mean, it's just complete sort of an end of a line in just running into the savannah. Subsequent neglect has left much of the track damaged, while in Niamey itself, the heat has similarly made the line unusable. And, you know, it's worth saying that the same could be seen in other places. The plan, for example, for a line 248 kilometres long from Mahadi, which is Niger's second city, to Kano in Nigeria. That, again, ignores the significant level of instability in northern Nigeria, which includes protection payments to local power brokers for economic activity. Now, the reason this is particularly significant is sub-Saharan Africa, well, Africa as a whole, in fact, but particularly sub-Saharan Africa, is the major area of population growth in the world. Nigeria is due by 2050 to replace the United States as the third most populous country. That assumes not a vast emigration. So what one has got is the attempt to provide infrastructure in an area where you might assume there would be rising demand is simply failing. And this situation creates the demographic conundrum of modern rail. There are all sorts of people like myself, like you, Graham, who benefit from trains. Graham uses the train pretty daily to go from Ely to London for his commuting. I use it at least weekly. There are lots of people who benefit from train, generally affluent people who are highly articulate and who are able to explain why it should attract particular fundings. But in fact, with the rising population and much of it being in areas such as sub-Saharan Africa, a decreasing percentage of the global population may travel by rail. Yet at the same time, because that population is rising so rapidly, about 8 billion now, maybe about 9.8 billion in 2050, the aggregate number of those so doing may still rise. And this creates issues of provision, of funding, of equity, with competing demands for more or less expenditure on rail. And if this is the case for passengers, it's even more so in some respects for freight. At the same time, far from there being a correct answer, whatever that's supposed to mean, and only foolish people believe that, the context will vary greatly as national populations and their political systems follow very different paths. So this can be seen, for example, in rail versus road battle. It can be seen within the smaller world of rail in rail battles over provision focused on freight, as in the United States, or passengers, as in China and Western Europe. For European middle class commentators. There is a failure to note, of course, the perspective provided by buses, which provide public transport, but generally for the less affluent. So to complicate the picture further, there are fertility rates are falling in many countries, and it's possible that the world's population will peak between 2050 and the end of the century. The rich world currently has about 3 people of working age for everyone over 65. By 2050, there could be less than 2, which implies higher taxes, lower returns for savers, which means investors in rail. And you ask the question, just how many workers as a percentage of a population will be commuting into New York or Shanghai or London in the middle of the century, and what precisely you feel this should entail. Now, we could go on further by noting that several years ago, the answer was widely seen by enthusiasts who are always apt to clutch at magic bullets. Don't I know it from my earlier work in military history, still continuing work. But the answer was held to be China. China had the ability, the technology, the willingness to provide both modest cost elsewhere in the world, and China held the future of rail. And indeed, between 2013 and 2019, Chinese companies signed $61.6 billion worth of rail construction contracts with 34 countries, 47% in Asia and 34% in Africa, Malaysia and Nigeria being the largest parties in each category. And that seemed to be the answer. But of course, we now know that the situation, well, it was obvious from the word go, the situation was more complicated. Chinese schemes do not have necessarily the outcomes in technical construction quality, in operating effectiveness that have been anticipated, and the financing has often meant heavy debt burdens, which have hit hard, notably, but not only, in Sri Lanka, Pakistan and Laos. Granting resources, including control over ports as collateral for debts, increases the problem. And corruption has also been an issue with, for example, the Chinese-backed East Coast Rail Link in Malaysia in 2015, linked to claims of large-scale embezzlement by Malaysian politicians. Meanwhile, stronger Chinese capital controls have created increasing commitments to match the cost implications of inflation today. So the exportability of the Chinese rail model is problematic. And, you know, if you look at some headlines, you know, countries like Angola can be held up as success stories. But many countries, this is less apparent. And all of this is before the issues of political stability. So the idea, for example, of a railway going down to Baluchistan to provide a Chinese route to the Indian Ocean has very much been hit by instability in Baluchistan. Obviously, the Ukraine war of 2022 onwards has affected ideas about rail links across Eurasia, not least if there are going to be more Ukrainian drone attacks on Russian communication hubs. And in the meantime, anyway, the Russian transport system is increasingly directed to military purposes. So there are significant problems with many of the bold ideas that were put forward by people who thought that geopolitics was a description of reality as opposed to a rhetoric of power. Now, it's true that war is not at the forefront of rail planning in most states. But nevertheless, in most states, there are still political issues about affordability and investment. And these Political issues have been enhanced, both pro and anti-investment, in the case of environmentalism. Environmentalism, both as a rhetoric and as a political injunction and governmental requirement, can mean an emphasis on rail because of the obloquy attracted to large-scale road movements. But on the other hand, environmentalism also can mean, as for example the Chinese discovered in Java, that there are complaints when you try and uproot communities as a result of or environments, natural environments, for new plans. One of the reasons HS2 is so expensive is because of the viaducts and tunnels deemed necessary for these purposes. Now, in Europe, there is a very strong emphasis on the rationale of environmentalism, and there has been progress. There are there are more fuel efficient trains, and that is marvelous. But I think it's fair to say that there are many circumstances in which the situation is less attractive. So let's look at California, always worthy of news. In the Bay Area, Facebook, you may remember Facebook, that hoped from 2017 to revitalize an 18-mile rail route, not too ambitious, you might think, an 18-mile rail route from Union City on the east side of San Francisco Bay, over the abandoned Dumbarton Rail Bridge, and up the San Francisco Peninsula, which was intended to make commuting easier and could be politically sold as being intended to cut emissions. This was also regarded as tremendously benign, as it meant that commuting, which was an aspect of the local housing costs in the Bay Area, could be addressed without so much environmental problems. But being a key part of the world's most prosperous economy, and this is a situation very different from Niger, where we started off, could not ensure success. There was the regulatory environment across the 9 counties of the Bay Area. There were 27 transit agencies, and their views, issues, and planning cycles did not coincide. What a surprise. I hope we won't get into trouble in terms of slander by noting that personalities played a role also in these differences. This affected plans for operating the new system, which was originally designed for 2028 and attracted a lot of attention, etc., etc. There were also the specific factors linked to the COVID pandemic and the decline of office work. Facebook, as a result, abandoned the project in 2021. One of the enormous number of projects for railways that have hit the buffers, metaphorically, and which, as I've said, don't tend to receive sufficient attention. Nor, indeed, do the problems with new technology. I mean, I've already mentioned that in many respects, trains still use technological systems that would have not seemed new in the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s. Now, it's true, there have been some improvements. So maglev, magnetic levitation systems, which I can remember some time ago, attracted a lot of attention, notably in China when one was introduced near Shanghai Airport. Took a lot of interest. And there are others operational in Japan and South Korea. But it needs to say, first of all, this wasn't new. It was actually patented in America in 1905. But also, they haven't worked terribly well. None of these systems are particularly long. More generally, what has happened is that software application has made it easier to ensure that existing systems, and notably their timetabling, are workable and robust, while also saving labour by introducing automated working for example, signalling to driving. Though don't tell the British trade unions that. But the practicality of actually then using those lower costs to expand, or the potential for lower costs, to expand train systems has not really been followed. And, you know, let's bear in mind, it's not just the British. The French, for example, can teach you, can teach anybody anything about rail strikes. Less positively, as we've mentioned already in Africa, but I want to now talk about Brazil, Latin America's most populous country. Areas of major population growth see few realistic plans for new provision. They're always plans, but they endlessly are pushed back or postponed. So in Brazil, there are long-standing plans for new high-speed lines between Rio and Sao Paulo, which are relatively close, as well as more fanciful ideas of a route on to Manaus on the Amazon, one in which riverboats provided most of the coverage. Now, you can focus on the new plan. So, you know, 1989, I can remember a plan for a line from Rio to São Paulo was launched with great fanfare. Of course, there was far less fanfare when the plan was rapidly dropped due to the cost and the lack of both public and private funding. It's all very well to talk about public-private partnerships. Often there's no money in either, or both of them have no appetite for the risk, or looked at differently, both of them understand that the projectors who make the noise are actually often, as it were, unrealistic. At that stage, all plans for a Brazilian high-speed train system were put aside. They were revived from 2000 with plans for lines between these cities as well as many others. But none, however, has been started. In part, politics played a role, political rivalries, but it's no simple case of the right being opposed to rail, which you could argue passenger rail is the case in the USA. Instead, the right-wing government of Bolsonaro, the president from 2019 to 22, was very interested in private investment in rail as a means to improve the economy. He backed a 1,000-kilometer railway into Amazonia, in order to make it less expensive to move soybeans and grains to the coast, and in order to speed up his plan to develop Amazonia. The plan had scant concern for the environment or indigenous people and reflected instead Bolsonaro's strong links to agribusiness. But if you look at, and you know, this is not a secret, it's in print. If you look at the National Logistics Plan in 2022 for Brazil, it reported that 67.7% of cargo in Brazil travels by road, 21.5% by rail, and 9.5% by waterways. It's very difficult to see how they are going to change that. The plan was that the percentage by rail would be increased to 40% by 2035, and that there would be national unification. There would be 22,250 kilometres of new railway construction. Well, all one can say is it's not happening. Ditto for bold plans in Peru, for example. You know, mismanagement, shining path terrorism. There's all sorts of problems. Take Venezuela. Now, Venezuela should be one of the wealthiest countries in South America. It has enormous oil wealth. And of course, it had a government under Chavez and his successor Maduro, who were very committed to rail for all the standard left-wing reasons. So different to Bolsonaro in Brazil, but the same idea that rail is a way to move the country forward, etc., etc. And there was a scheme for a 468-kilometer high-speed railway for which the Chinese were willing to do for $7.5 billion. This was a project to connect the east and west of the country and help in the development of the plains south of the coastal mountains. And President Chavez was at the groundbreaking, made all bold plans. There was to be technology transfer to Japan, from China, sorry, four factories to produce sleepers, rails, and rolling stock. It was agreed as part of the 2006 National Socialist Plan, unfortunate phrase, but there you go. President Chavez always had tin ears, as part of the National Socialist Plan for Railway Development, with 15 new lines comprising 8,500 miles by 2030. In reality, by 2011, only 31% of the 468-kilometre line had been built. Work was then halted for the first time. And by 2013, the State Rail Authority owed $400 million to the Chinese consortium and work stopped completely. In 2015, the Chinese managers left. The facilities in the railway factory were looted and vandalised by an armed group of local residents. And by 2021, only 40 kilometres were in operation and there was no stable electricity supply for them. So, you know, and I could go on. If you look at the plan for the 4,000-kilometre railway to link Dakar to Port Sudan, it's just implausible. It's just not happening. And repeatedly, in country after country, it's not happening. Or if you take, for example, existing lines, the long line in Mauritania is a 704-kilometre line from iron workings in the interior to an export port built in 1960 to 63, nationalised in 1974. But the Mauritanians annexed the southwest part of the Southern Sahara in 1976. This led to the line being attacked by Polisario forces, and that cut the line until such time as the Mauritanians retired. The largest country in Central Africa is Congo, which has been much disrupted by corruption, and road traffic is currently responsible for 97% of Congolese freight movement. There are lots and lots of plans to change it. There have been. Nothing much has happened. South Africa has a poor rail system. It actually inherited from the apartheid, noxious as that was, but it inherited a relatively effective one. But since then, there's been corruption, violence, mismanagement of rail freight, inadequate expenditure and maintenance, but bountiful spending on wages and contracts, so that the railway has in fact become a glorified protection system for trade union bureaucrats and the rail authority bureaucrats, Transnet, the state-owned enterprise, which indeed is true of the situation in many rail systems. When you talk about the state, you're often talking about a protection racket, running systems linked to particular political parties as part of a carve-up. And the South African railway system is getting steadily worse, with all sorts of problems that that entails for movements through South African ports. China has not been a particularly benign participant, nor elsewhere. In Uganda, for example, earlier this year, a contract with the China Harbour Engineering Company to build a 170-mile railway was cancelled. The Chinese railway in Djibouti doesn't work well. The China-Tanzania railway does not work well. And there are inadequate rail provision across most of Africa, including both in freight and passengers, including situations within cities and between cities. In the Middle East, where the countries are more affluent or more stable, you can see the development of effective metro systems in Dubai, in Doha, Riyadh, Tel Aviv, Tunis. There have been many others where incompetence, corruption and politics have played an enormously limiting factor. I mean, Baghdad, for example, is a classic example. Both, in fact, Iraq as a whole, both the Baghdad idea and the Baghdad-Basra high-speed line. Repeatedly, there have been plans geopolitically looking marvellous to, for example, in the case of Iraq, provide a fast route on to Turkey and enable, for example, people to move from the Persian goods from the Persian Gulf to the Black Sea and the Med. But the actual viability of these have been relatively limited. In India, there are plans for high-speed trains, and some of it has succeeded. But I think it's fair to say that the Indian railway system has failed to match some of the bold plans that have been announced. And, you know, for example, connecting the Diamond Quadrilateral, that European tourists who go on luxury trains often fail completely to understand what the experience of rail travel is in India. And there's been high vulnerability to accidents as well as to political disruption. So in 2022, protests over a new military recruitment plan led to mass vandalizing of rail facilities in the provinces of Bihar, Uttar Pradesh, and Bengal. And the high rate of population growth in India means that the problem is that although provision is slowly improving, it's not matching the rate of population growth. More generally, much of the freight need in India is met by road transport, and notably so given the difficulties of matching freight requirements to rail provision. It's easier to improve or cope with roads than to install new rail links. So also in Sri Lanka, where in terms of ton kilometres carried, 97%, the last figures I looked at, were by motor vehicles, 1% by water transport, and 2% by rail. Now, we could go on. I'm going to stop this in a second. I think I'm making the point. The figures I've got for Egypt, for Mexico, we're not talking about failed states here, are really difficult. And of course, global fiscal and monetary tightening from 2022 suggests a worsening situation for the future of rail, which hasn't been adequately taken on board by some of the enthusiasts. Treasurers are well aware of it. Money market investors are well aware of it. But the marked rise in interest rates mean that the return on capital is becoming more problematic, greatly affecting investment options, whilst on top of that, there is a more general strain on liquidity. So, you know, we're as it were in a similar way to a 19th century fiscal crisis and its effect on rail provision. Most of the current financing environment for railway development is poor. Rail is unattractive to private capital, in part as a result of the very long time framework required to gain any decent return, but also due to the poor management of new infrastructure projects, the slow pace of technological development, and the running cost and poor management of railways. I mean, I think it's fair to say rail management is not generally characterized by high caliber. I'm not implying that everybody in rail management is this the case with, but I don't think one would say that the best and the brightest generally go into rail management. Although there have been significant improvements, I mean, the most obvious one, containers, are nevertheless, containerization itself poses problems. The splitting of a full container load into parts for final delivery to customers is a classic one, and in practical terms, normal road trailers, lorries, are more efficient as means of directing resources. So we then turn, before having a brief discussion, and then we'll move on, as it were, in the next one to look at one or two other situations. But let's just briefly talk, since it's always fun, about HS2. Now, I think it's worth saying that the cost is driven by a whole series of factors, including the crowdedness of England, the nature of the topography, the environmental problems, etc., etc. But leaving that aside, and those are very significant, the underlying claims, for example, that the line would create 500,000 jobs were groundless. And although the case offered by capacity pressures on the London to Scotland lines remained pertinent, it's not clear that it was worth the cost even at the lower projections. By constructing, in effect, a new line for long-range passenger services, the idea was that local and freight services would improve. But by 2022, it was suggested that the benefit-cost ratio had fallen below one. In other words, it would cost more to build than the advantages it can bestow. And I think that is partly because there is a rhetoric linked to rail, particularly to bold projections on rail, that does not look sufficiently at their deficiencies, and that it is too easy to invest politically in bold premises. So, you know, it's well known that there were alternatives if you wish to put money in for rail, the services run by TransPennine Express, or, for example, if you think about minor ones, the Borders Railway in Scotland, which was closed in 69, opened in 2015, connecting Edinburgh to Galashiels and Melrose, you know, an actually much cheaper way to do things, or reopening the line from Oakhampton to Plymouth, which I think I'm right in saying was costed at 800 million. Now, 800 million is a lot of money, but it's nowhere near the money that they are throwing around. So what I would close on before taking, you know, some conversation on this is the argument that what we have seen with rail, and we're going to pursue some of these elements next time, what we have seen with rail is foolish optimism. And that this foolish optimism is unfortunate because, as I mentioned last time, railways are tremendously helpful in some areas, bulk movement of goods such as iron ore, for example, commuting into major cities. They are really important. But the idea of a universal service providing most transport needs is simply inappropriate for both passengers and freight. Graham.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Professor Black. I suppose what we're seeing time and time and again is the triumph of hope over experience with these projects, particularly the larger, more costly projects. At what stage does reality intrude, though? I mean, there have been so many examples of projects not meeting their potential, going massively over budget, never delivering what's intended, or even being, you know, abandoned or scaled back midway because they're just simply not viable. How is it that despite this, the process keeps going on and we keep having new examples? Why does reality never intrude in this process?
Well, I mean, you know, you're a political journalist as well as a historian, Graham. I mean, you know how, as it were, it is easy to invest in rhetoric and in projects and in terms of unlocking the future, whatever that's supposed to mean. So it shouldn't surprise us. What is interesting is that this now is very much a matter of public guarantees, loan guarantees, public purchasing, public procurement, because on the whole, private concerns, whilst they're willing to build the thing, are not willing to risk their own money. And I think that's very, very, very instructive. So what you've got is the hubris of government, the belief, we've seen this in our country, of course, with enormously expensive and bold promises in, you know, social welfare and health. We see it in the United States with extraordinary attempts to reorder, as it were, the politics of Southwest Asia and so on, and, you know, ideas of state building, etc., etc. Government in the 20th century, from ideologies of both left and right, from political systems as a whole, and we might discuss this on a future program, it would be very interesting, found it very hard indeed to say, we'll try and muddle on, we'll try and do as well as possible. Instead of which, the right invested in the same rhetoric as the left of improving society, changing economies, transforming everything, becoming, as it were, the people that made modernity here. And didn't understand the deficiencies and liabilities of those projects.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that for a long period, and to some extent, to a great extent, still, China is seen as the solution to all these problems of financing and indeed delivery. And yet, often these projects have gone badly wrong. Can you say just a little bit more about typically how this kind of financial and delivery package that the Chinese offer, and why that appears so attractive, and also why it so typically goes wrong?
Well, the Chinese offer better loan guarantees and better purchasing deals than the principal foreign competitors. But the costings always rise dramatically. And countries discover that they've taken on a liability which they can't discharge, and that the Chinese, as it were, who were going to, let us say the Chinese have guaranteed to pay $8 billion towards the cost of a project, and the project is designed to come in at $10 billion, and in return for this, the Chinese are going to have X and Y. The project comes in at $20 billion, and the Chinese still demand X and Y, and they then expect, since it's a Chinese company that's doing this, the host country to divvy up the other $12 billion.
And a final point, because we're getting close to the end of time.
Well, that's interesting. You know when the millennium is. Well done, Graham. Not living in Ely, I don't know. The end of time announced. There is the clock going. The end of time is announced first on this program.
The end is nigh. The
following is... in America next.
The end is nigh, but hopefully not quite yet. But just a final point was the way in which technological development hasn't really happened on the railways at a pace to mitigate against the ever-increasing costs. You mentioned, in that context, you mentioned maglev. I've been on the maglev train in Shanghai, and it's a very pleasant and exciting experience. But why hasn't maglev taken off? You said it had difficulty...
Well, it has taken off, but you mean why hasn't...
Why hasn't it become more commonly adopted?
Well, because it needs relatively expensive specialised equipment and track, and because it doesn't really have the capacity to move freight, the weight, So in other words, systems that may work quite well for moving small groups of passengers aren't necessarily appropriate for moving heavier loads, whether more significant number of passengers or whether freight of any type. So that's a real problem with it. And we've had a lot of attempts with new technologies, some of which can work in some circumstances. Tilting trains, for example, I mentioned, help you to go around curves. But the engineering problems and costs of these, not least when you're having to deal with them and getting them to work on existing track, existing routes, for existing things, you've got to confront tunnels and bridges. For new routes, you have to confront land purchase and station purchase as well. These are very considerable sums.
Mm-hmm. Well, we must leave it there, but we will pick up again in the next episode. Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.